continue moving forward. Finish up with Texas v. Johnson. So we actually have a harder job today than we did yesterday because we need to look at the dissents. Now, the majority opinion is made up by the most judges. And again, the outcome of the majority is not relevant. They could reverse, they could, you know, remand, but ultimately at least five of them believe one result. Dissents can be fragmented because, as we all know, we can disagree for different reasons, or we can agree for different reasons. So with these dissents, that you actually have a variation of opinion. But you also have a concurrence. So we get the majority, which, if you remember, it was five justices, but there was a concurrence by Kennedy. So before we can understand what was in the dissents and the concurrence, we need to take a step back. Does the act of flag burning receive First Amendment protection? Yes or no, according to this judgment? Why, Donovan? When does an act become speech?
Well, because they used expression to do it.
Okay, expression. So it wasn't the words that the majority looked at. It was the act expressing what?
Expressing is like political opinion.
An idea, a view. Okay. When does an expression, an act, an expressive act, get First Amendment protections? It must do two things.
Intend to convey a message and understood by the people who view it.
Alright. So you have to intend to convey the message. It just can't be, like I said last class, falling down and looking dumb. Because did you intend to convey a message by falling down and looking dumb? No. But this guy was intending to send a message. And it must be, as you said,
understood by the people who view it.
Understood. Meaning it's not subject to interpretation. expression gets First Amendment protection if intent and it's easily understood. Okay, now, remember, this just means that this act is going to be subject to review under strict scrutiny. Because now the court is saying these things are equal to the First Amendment. First Amendment is a liberty. And any law that seeks to restrict the liberty gets subject to strict scrutiny. In the end, the Texas law, was that deemed constitutional or unconstitutional?
Unconstitutional.
Why?
Because it violated his First Amendment.
Okay, so we got a violation of First Amendment. What about the law? We need to go back. What about the law? Strict scrutiny test. What are the parts of strict scrutiny that we looked at last class?
Compelling government interest.
All right. So first, there has to be a compelling government interest. All right, so by default, statute equals no unless compelling government interest. What was Texas's compelling government interest? At least what did they claim?
Maintaining the peace and maintaining the image of unity.
So we're trying to maintain the image of the flag, the nation, national unity, and maintain the peace. That is a compelling interest. In this particular instant, did the Supreme Court believe that argument was valid? No. What about the other prompts of strict scrutiny?
Narrowly tailored.
In other words, the restriction is so small that it's not going to impede any other things. That it's only going to stop that one wrongdoing. Was this statute narrow enough to stop flag burning? No, why not?
Because there's other ways to cause the disturbance of the peace.
Well, that's half of it. So, yeah, there's other ways to cause disturbances of the peace. But is this statute going to stop flag burning?
No.
So it doesn't achieve either. And what's the last one?
Necessary to achieve interest.
That this restriction is necessary to achieve. So this law was not narrowly tailored to achieve what they were trying to do, and this law is not necessary. If they don't want disturbing of the peace, don't they already have a statute on the book that says no disturbing of the peace and define it? And can they stop all flag burning? No, because under federal law, they're supposed to retire flags. All right then. So Texas's statute couldn't even pass a single single prong of strict scrutiny according to the majority. Questions? All right. What does Justice Kennedy have to say? Why did he feel the need to write a concurring opinion?
He's
said how they sometimes have to make decisions because they're right, but not, but they don't like the decision.
What is the job of the court? The job of the court is to make tough decisions based on their interpretation of the law and constitution. Kennedy's just basically saying, look, I don't agree with what the guy was doing. But just because I don't agree doesn't mean Texas has a right to stop it. Absolutely. Do you think, in Kennedy's opinion, Johnson even knew the significance of what he was doing? No, he kind of makes it seem like Johnson was just a dumb kid, right? Yeah. So, how can I put it this way? I was trying to summarize it real easy. So, essentially, the right decision isn't always more... The right thing, as under the law or as a constitution, isn't always popular. Now, by the way, very powerful statement in his concurrence. Because this is the message that many of us do not receive at any point in our life. A, we're lied to about the political system that we have. We're told there's a democracy. And we're also told whatever the opinion of the most people is always right, because it's the most people. Well, I always use this as an analogy. Way, way, way back when, before I'm assuming most of you were born, back when I was just a lowly middle school teacher, Britney Spears came on the scene with her first song, and all of the girls wanted to be like Britney Spears for about 3 months. She was popular, she was the it girl, and then someone else came on. Well, based on the snapshot in time, this meant there was only one artist that we should think is great. Britney Spears and all the other rest are junk, because that's what most of the people who were buying CDs at the time wanted. But the problem with believing that is trends. People's opinions change. So if you're going to make a law that encapsulates an idea in a moment, even if it seems popular, what happens tomorrow? So, according to Kennedy, the best decision the court could make, it's not perfect, but the best decision is no, we cannot prevent this. Does anyone disagree? And you can disagree if you want. All right, well, just based on what we know of what the majority said, how many people agree with the majority holding that this law should be struck and down? So that means the... Okay, how many people agree with the outcome? Okay, so most of you. So some of you means you're siding with one of the dissents. All right. What is a dissent?
A disagreement with the majority?
It's just a disagreement. Is having a disagreement with a majority, is that okay?
Yeah.
Absolutely. First dissent was written by the Chief Justice. And joining him were two other justices. So there were three that agreed with this dissent. What was the basis of Rehnquist's dissent?
that they government has a legitimate interest in preserving the flag's symbolic value?
Government in general, has legit interest in flag. Why? Why?
To preserve the American flag's symbolic value, but also separate free speech from burning the flag. They should be two separate things.
All right, let's focus first on the flag as a symbol. Does the flag as a symbol mean the same thing for everyone? No, it does not. But, in general, does our flag represent good or evil?
It depends on people's perspective.
I'm going to agree with you that it depends. But overall, if you were to do a litmus test, even today, and as divisive as our society has become, do you think more people would say it's good than bad?
In America?
In America. Yeah. I don't care what everyone else in the world thinks. They're not as good of us. They're not Americans. It's America. Yeah, I think we'll all agree. The vast majority of people here believe in our symbol as being something good. Is it a symbol worthy of sacrifice? How many hundreds of thousands of men and women have given their lives for the flag? Freely. Because while we've had a couple of wars where there were drafts, the vast majority of the soldiers who served our countries over the 200 plus years have volunteered. You think people would volunteer for something that was evil? No. Okay. So, what does the flag itself represent? In even in just basic design.
Freedom.
For whom?
People.
Which people?
Under it.
The people who live under the flag. So if you choose to live under this flag, and by the way, if you're born here, it's still a choice because you haven't left. But if you choose to live under this flag, you are going to be given something that nowhere else on earth gets. Freedom to be who you want to be. What also does this represent, according to Justice Rehnquist?
Unity.
Unity. How so? Was any of the original 13 colonies represented any more so than any others? So we know how the colonies are represented on the flag, right?
The stripes.
The stripes and the stars. The original flag had 13. Was any stripe or star bigger than any of the other ones? No. So this means if you come from tiny little Rhode Island, which was considered a small state and still is, or a large state, like a Massachusetts at the time, or a Pennsylvania or Virginia, under this flag, you're going to be the same. It's a huge, huge symbol. Huge symbol. Now, by the way, did the Congress have to select the design that it selected? No. If you know anything about the War for Independence, each of the states had their own flags. And many of the Continental armies had their own flags. And then there were other compatriots that had their own flag. Heck. I have one right here that originates from the War of Independence. The Gadsden flag. Don't tread on me. Or I'll bite you. There's also the tree of liberty, tree of hope. There was also a whole bunch of other symbols. But the Congress decided upon our flag to show that we're all in this together, to succeed or fail. Has that symbol been built upon throughout our history? Made more strong, leading to more reverence?
Yes.
What were some of the historical examples that Rehnquist gave?
The Civil War.
Civil War. What about the Civil War?
The American flag, the stars representing the rebel states. He considered the conflict not a war between two nations, but an attack by 11 states against the national government.
Who's he?
Rehnquist. I think.
Rehnquist, when he died, he was old, but I don't think he was old enough to be someone important in the Civil War.
It gets kind of confusing. It's all over the place.
I'll help you. Who was the president of these United States during the Civil War?
Abraham Lincoln.
And why did Lincoln engage in the war to begin with? What was Lincoln's political position?
Abolitionism.
No. He wasn't fighting the war to end slavery. If he would have done that, all of the slave states that stayed in the Union would have left. And the Confederacy would have won. What was Lincoln fighting the war for? You alluded to it.
To just bring the southern states back into the Union.
The Union! He didn't view the Confederacy as a separate country. He viewed them as a state of rebellion. And he was trying to bring them back. Because, by the way, if you have a disagreement and you throw a little hissy fit and you go storming out of the room, do you actually solve the problem? Lincoln wanted to work with the South. Look, you got a problem. Let's see if we can figure it out. But what did the South do? I secede. Everywhere where the Union troops went, the stars and stripes are there. Not the stars and bars, stars and stripes. Telling those people they can come back. And by the way, when the war came to an end, the Union armies go through town to town and shoot everybody who was involved? No, they didn't. Yeah, it was a messed up reconstruction. We talked about that. Real bad. But the intent was, look, let's just bring it back together. Let's heal the nation. Coincidentally, one of the things that pissed me off during the so-called Summer Love is when they started tearing down all of the statues, particularly of the Confederate generals that were in the southern states. All of the statues that they torn down, they were actually destroying images of Americans. Because back in the 1910s and 20s, to heal the wounds of Reconstruction, the U.S. government adopted all Confederate soldiers and established them all as members of the United States Army. So they received all honors that they were entitled to. Because it was messed up. But if you keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing, eventually they're going to fight back. So to heal the Union, you got to keep everyone together. It may not be a perfect solution, but you got to come up with a compromise. That's all Lincoln wanted to do. And the South didn't want to hear it. The flag was there. Other examples.
World War II and the Cold War.
World War II.
All the proxy Cold War stuff.
Exactly. We were fighting a global war against the communists. And everywhere our flag went, the people in general had more freedom than they would have had under the Soviet system. And by the way, if any of you are leaning towards socialism or communism, go find some books and read what life was like under Stalin or Mao Zedong or Pol Pot or even Ho Chi Minh, all of the communist leaders. Wasn't so good if you disagreed with the government. they would kill you. I don't know what the court's trying to do. You disagree with the government and you're getting protected. Other examples that Rehnquist used. Fort McHenry during the War of 1812 that led to the Star-Spangled Banner. After the Battle of Iwo Jima, when the Marines brought the flag and planted it up on Mount Suribachi, that famous raising the flag. Everywhere the flag went was good. All right, second primary argument of Rehnquist. Did Congress act on this issue? Did Congress ever take the time to act on the issue of flag burning? Come on, guys, I told you we were going over the dissents. So that meant you had to open everything up and go back in. Did Congress ever pass a law that dealt with flag burning? Yes or no? They actually did in 1967. So if Congress acts and passes the Flag Desecration Act, should not states be allowed to do this?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, did anyone read the law? He put it in there. The law reads, and I quote, "Whoever knowingly mutilates, defaces, physically defiles, burns, maintains on the floor or ground, or tramples upon any flag of the United States shall be fined not more than $1,000 or imprisoned for not more than 1 year or both." Congress actually passed the law. That's still on the books, by the way. So the majority, according to Rehnquist, is saying there is no compelling government interest for Texas to try to protect the flag. But Congress did. And by the way, in the second clause of the act, Congress allowed the states to do the same. That's the reason why 48 out of the 50 states had similar statutes to Texas. So the majority opinion of the judges was this, but this was not popular opinion. The overwhelming opinion in the United States was that, look, this flag is so special that it's unique, and its uniqueness sets it apart. And by the way, did the Supreme Court in any of its preceding cases come close to allowing states to pass such statutes? He did. Did he not reference a couple of them? Even some of the cases that the majority cited, Rehnquist pointed out that in every single one, the Supreme Court was consistent. That burning the flag is an indignity. And that it's an indignity that the government has a right to prevent. Over and over again. But yet, in this particular instance, they found this way. What's up with that? Under the doctrine of stare decisis, shouldn't courts make their decisions based on precedent? But now we have the courts disagreeing with their own opinion.
Well, like it kind of seems like the date, like 1967, kind of seems like the height of the like Vietnam like protests. So
yep.
It might be seen as like one of those at the time like censorship laws and social media type thing, where it's like Like we shouldn't.
Context.
Yeah.
Context. So it's a reaction to the times.
Yeah.
Okay. But still, the fact that Congress, I'm not going to disagree with you, but still the fact that Congress itself passed the law, that kind of bolsters Rehnquist's dissent, no? Well, I'm not saying whether we disagree or not. I'm just saying that Rehnquist is making a very strong argument, at least in my opinion. All right, I suppose the last thing we can come down to is his closing remarks. Go down to his last paragraph if you got it open. Rehnquist says, "A constitution wisely places limits on the power of legislative majorities to act." So again, like we said in the beginning, the purpose of the constitution is to limit the government. But here's the thing. The declaration of such limits by the majority, or the fact that the court is going to, let me rephrase this in a way, because I summarized it, and I don't remember exactly what he said. I should have just copied and pasted it. But, so the Constitution limits, the Supreme Court, as we know, redefines or reaffirms those limits, because the Constitution going back to Supreme Court going back to Marbury v. Madison is the interpreter of the Constitution. And they have at times said Congress cannot. But from its own case history comes this quote. "The declaration of such limits is, at all times, a question of much delicacy, which ought seldom, if ever, to be decided in the affirmative in a doubtful case." 5-4. This is not a unanimous decision where all the judges agree. This is 5-4. Do you want 5 of 9, the barest of majorities, to go against the will of the majority of the people? Do you want that? And by the way, I'm not asking for yes or no. This is just rhetorical. If this occurs, could there not be consequences? It could. Because how many people understand what the court is supposed to do? In the sense, as Kennedy explained it. Or how many people in our country are low-information voters and base their opinions solely on what they hear on social media or the news or the radio without actually understanding how things are supposed to happen? And if the majority of the people are actually illiterate on these types of matters, 5-4 decisions do what to our society?
Split.
So at the end of the day, do we want to take this risk on this issue? I don't know about you, but if you actually read the dissent, understood it, I know I was just like, "Ooh, man, Chief Justice, that's kind of mic drop." Think about it, and we'll keep it in context. What is the only major issue that the Democrats are pushing in this political election? We keep hearing it over and over and over and over again. That they're blaming Donald Trump for.
Abortion.
How much more divisive can you get than the issue of abortion? Well, the politicians are using it as a wedge issue to divide us. But in the grand scheme of things, is that the most important thing that our country's facing?
No.
You know how many politicians ran after this decision was made? A lot. This is one of the decisions that actually helped Bill Clinton get elected. So Rehnquist is saying, careful here. We are in dangerous times. Tread carefully. Why are we disrupting something that's been in place for 200 years? Why are we disrupting something that the people revere? Careful. Questions? Any of you read Stephen's dissent? It's a little shorter than Rehnquist's. You can't scroll. You can't find it if you scroll, because with this website, they have all of the footnotes embedded as paragraphs. They're not separated.
So
you have to go through and you have to read it in Rehnquist's ends, where he basically says, I disagree with the opinion of the majority. Then there's two footnotes, and then right after that, it says Justice Stevens' dissent. Well, that's all right. I'll cover. Stevens. And by the way, Stevens was a liberal leftist. Rehnquist was on the right. So this was not Democrats versus Republicans, left versus right. This is just like in the majority. You have left and rightists, and in the dissents, you have leftists and rightists. Stevens said that the flag is more than a symbol. More than. Because it signifies our society. Flag equals USA. As every flag does. He mentions two other countries' flags. He mentions the French tricolor, which was made during the French Revolution to symbolize fraternity and brotherhood. And then he also mentions the dun-dun-dun swastika. People's opinions on France are based on their flag. People's of their opinions of Germany are based on the German flag at the time. Well, ours is the same. But Stevens points out, have we been a perfect nation? No. But in general, freedom, equality of opportunity, religious tolerance, goodwill. America is one of the few exceptions in the human history where, for the most part, we lean on doing the good for humanity. Again, we do screw things up. No one's perfect. But overall, we're always trying to do what's right. He also says, you can't measure the value. The actual value, quantifiable value of the flag. You can't measure it. But, should not we today strive to protect this flag for tomorrow's generation? FYI, there was once a point when you went to grammar school, you learned about the American dream. Where every person go to school, get an education, go out and get a job, and do best for themselves, as good as they can, based on their own efforts. Well, don't we want that for our kids, and our grandkids, and our great-grandkids? Or do we want them to fall victim to tyranny? Under a Stalinist regime, or a Hitlerian regime. Or a Mao Zedong, Chiang Kai regime. No, we don't. We want them to have the same things that we have. So if we recognize that the flag is valuable, and we can't say how much, but it's really good, shouldn't we want to keep the good times going? By the way, what happens if you allow the image to be tarnished? Here's the irony, and I lived through it. The moment this decision came down, Americanism, rah, rah, rah. Rocky Balboa versus Ivan Drago, the spirit of the 80s started descending into a more nihilistic view of reality. There was no good versus evil, but instead, it all became blurry. Well, Stevens pointed out prophetically in 1989 that sanctioning the public desecration of the flag will tarnish its value, not only for those who cherish it, but those who, like Johnson, and I quote, will seek to don the robes of martyrdom by burning it. By not protecting it, you're allowing it to be destroyed. Last point on Stevens.
But if you do protect it, you tarnish what it stands for, kind of thing, as well.
Well, Stevens disagrees with that.
Yeah.
I get what you're saying.
But
Stevens, he disagreed. Because he said, because you protect the flag doesn't mean that you're being forced to worship it. Desecration does not turn on the substance of the actor's message. Rather, it turns on whether those who view the act will take serious offense. So, Johnson's opinion that he didn't like Reagan or Reagan's policies, the fact that he needed to express that by burning, he could have expressed it other ways. Because does burning a flag directly link his opinion? No, he's just acting in an act of desecration. He's burning something. And I like the hypotheticals that Stevens throws in. What do you think the college would do to you if you, on, say, the statue of the Madonna that's over there, you decided you didn't like Catholicism and decided you were going to cover it in spray paint?
Well, it's destruction of private property.
Well, I realize that, but does not the college have a vested interest in protecting that?
Yeah.
All right, well, Stevens used the example of the Lincoln Monument.
Would that be linked to a hate crime?
Wait, hold on. What's a hate crime?
It's like they link it to a lot of stuff, but it's like if you were like, I hate Catholicism, and then you destroyed that, that would be like considered.
Yeah, but can you say, I hate America, and would they link that to burning the flag?
Well, they decided no.
Right, exactly. But maybe they should.
Maybe.
All right, so just to wrap this up real quick, Stevens points out that there were precedents in place where where the speaker's opinion was what was punished, but the method of giving that opinion was not punished. So, for example, if you wanted to yell bad things about the government and you used a microphone or a bullhorn, would the government lock you up for using the bullhorn? No, but what could run you in trouble? What comes out of your mouth? But look at what the court did here. They're saying just because he burned something, he's using that to use words. Well, how does fire equal words? And if you were to set fire to a government building that happened to have a flag on top of it, what would happen to you? Why? Yeah, you're not allowed to set fire to government buildings. So why should you be allowed to set fire to a government flag, which symbolizes the government in that building? You know what all these are? They're arguments. They're arguments for, they're arguments against. But at the end of the day, the biggest takeaway, because now we've done our third case. First off, it's up to the court to use judicial review to determine the constitutionality of laws. And if it's unconstitutional, Supreme Court can strike it down. We know that the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court through its appellate power is controlled by Congress. We know that. We know that at times your words could be a clear and present danger of the nature that the government has a legitimate interest in stopping. So you can go to jail for using words. And now we know there are times where you can do things that symbolize words, and that will be protected by the First Amendment. Well, let's see next case what happens when you use words and protest while using those words in a way that many people would deem to be offensive. That is Schneider v. Phelps. That's the next case on the list. Schneider v. Phelps. Now this one, I don't think... There is no dissent on this one. There is no dissent. Oh, if you came late, I have your quizzes. And...